Welcome to Who Knew.
I'm great. I was answering your question. Sorry. Wait, were you asking me or them?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Good.
You're right here, though. So.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
How was your week?
Oh, man. I'm just still getting used to things. It's fine. How was your week?
It's fine. It's okay. Went to work.
Great.
Usual. Do you have any updates or corrections, anything?
I do. I was doing research, and I remembered that there was something that I messed up on the last episode, and I don't remember it now.
Okay, so you don't have one.
That's
what I'm hearing.
I might pop up with it later on when I do remember it, so
okay.
Fair warning. I do have an update. I just can't remember right now.
Okay. We always put this at the end, but I want to put it at the beginning. If you want to go give us a follow on Instagram, that'd be cool. And then from there, you can get on our link tree and you can find all the other ways you can interact, whatever. We have a Gmail you can email if that's your thing. And then we have a Patreon as well. Other than that, let's get into it. Yeah?
Yes.
You want to go first or you want me to go first?
I don't know. Do you want to hear about an unsolved serial killer murder stream?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go.
I'll go first then. I'm going to be talking about the Texarkana Moonlight murders. Do you know what Texarkana is?
Mm-mm.
It sounds like a fantasy novel. You know what I mean? But it's not. It's a like city or town that's literally split by the state line of Texas and Arkansas. So part of it is in Miller County, Arkansas, and then the rest of it is in Bowie County, Texas. Though technically, if you Google it, it'll say it is Texarkana, Texas. It's weird. Like, apparently the post office is like literally split in half on the state line. It's so weird.
That's wild.
Yeah, I wonder if there's other cities like that. Anyways, so we're gonna go back to February 22nd of 1946. A man named Jimmy Hollis, who was 25, and a female, Mary Jean Larry, was 19. They had gone to see a movie. They were kind of like dating, so they wanted to get some quiet time after the movie. So, like a lot of people did back in the day, they went to a secluded road in Bowie County, Texas. And they just kind of like parked on the side of the road. A lot of people stated that it was like a lover's lane of sorts. So I guess if you want to that point or not. So it was around 11:55 at night when they had kind of like parked there and were hanging out. Eventually, a man came up flashing like a flashlight in the car. So they couldn't really see what was going on. And then he ordered them out of the car with a gun. And then they noticed that he had a burlap sack over his face. A lot of sources, though, changed what was covering his face.
It's very Zodiac.
Such as,
of
like,
him.
I feel like this is Zodiac. I will tell you more about it later. Anyways, he had like a burlap sack or a bag or a white sack, depending on what source you're reading. Either way, like, it was like a bag of sorts that was covering his head that had slits for eyes. And according to Mary, also had a mouth hole. So like I said, he was shining the flashlight in their faces, so they really couldn't see. So the man then ordered for Jimmy to take his pants off and then ended up beating Jimmy with the butt of his gun, and he ended up cracking his skull in two places and put Jimmy in a coma for several days. What I think is interesting is that Mary had said that she thought that him getting beat was so loud that she thought that the gun had gone off, but it was just his skull cracking. Ooh. So, it's so crazy.
Hopefully he never took his pants off. Hopefully he said no.
No, he took his pants off. Sorry. Yeah, he definitely took his pants off. Which is so weird because, like, I don't think anything came of it. So I wonder if he was just doing it to see if he could make them do whatever, you know what I mean? Just like some sort of control.
What a bummer, though. Like, you're pantsless and then you have a cracked skull.
Then you're getting the shit beat out of you. Yeah. So then the unknown male went after Mary and also beat her with the barrel of the gun. Barrel is very specific. So, like, she didn't get as severe of wounds from that. But unfortunately, he sexually assaulted her also with the gun barrel. So he again beat her with it and then ended up fleeing when he saw headlights of a car approaching. So according to one of my sources, which I don't know how reliable is, I'm just going to throw this out there, it's somehow I stumbled upon the forum of the Criminal Minds fandom It's literally criminalmindsfandom.com, so the TV show, if you're familiar. They apparently do research on a bunch of random cases and, like, look at them through, like, the Criminal Minds perspective and, like, give, like, profiles and stuff like that. It's so weird. Anyways, they reported that Mary was told to run by the assailant, and Mary reached an old car that was parked off the road, which, if this is true, I would assume that to be the assailant's car. And then the assailant caught up to her and asked why she ran. And she's like, well, you told me to. And then he called her a liar. And that's when he beat her and assaulted her. So I don't know if that's true because I could only find it on that forum. Regardless, I wanted to throw that out there because it's really interesting that he's like, go run away. And then she's like, okay. And then she stops and he's like, why did you run away? I don't know.
What a psycho.
Seriously. So after he left, Mary was able to leave because she didn't have as substantial wounds as Jimmy. She left and found a phone and called the police. Jimmy somehow regained consciousness while she was gone and was able to, I think, crawl at least to be seen by the roadway from a passerby. So he was able to get help as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, both of them recovered from their wounds. Like I said, Jimmy was in a coma for a few days. I don't know if it was like medically induced or whatever, but regardless, they recovered. They're alive. But they both had differing reports as to what happened, which is interesting. Also, part of me is thinking, like, Jimmy was in a coma, like he was unconscious. Like, how reliable was his memory based off of his injuries? But again, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. So Mary claimed that the man was black, but fairly light skinned. And Jimmy said that he believed the man was white and in his 30s. That was according to grunge.com. They also, on grunge.com, they said, like, they don't know how Mary could have thought that he was black because she never saw his face. And I'm like, well, then how the fuck did Jimmy know he was white? Because he never saw his face either. Like, I feel like she probably has a more reliable testimony out of this because she had more interaction with him.
Right.
But what the fuck do I know? So then everything's kind of settled with this one that happened in February. So about a little over a month later, the morning of March 24th, around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, Richard Griffin, who was 29, and Polly Ann Moore, who was 17, were found. Their bodies were found on another Bowie County back road, close to a bar named Club Dallas. So they were both shot several or one time, depending on the source, in the back of the head with a .32 revolver. Presumably, they were killed the night before, so on the 23rd of March. After looking for some, again, alone time, after having dinner with Richard's sister and her boyfriend, they were, like, on a double date, which is interesting to me because Richard was 29 and Polly Ann was 17. Eek. So that's cringe. But they had been dating for about 6 weeks. So I guess back in the day, though it's not acceptable, it happened. So the worst part is that when, like, law enforcement got there and they saw the bodies, they found the bloodstains on the ground outside of the car indicated that they had been killed outside of the vehicle, but their bodies were found in the vehicle. So the killer had brought their bodies back inside from the murder, probably because he didn't want to be caught and thought it was less suspicious for bloodstained ground to be there versus just bodies. So this is where the part, I'm a bullet early. So Polly, again, like, Mary before, was sexually assaulted. And so this is where the FBI got involved because they're like, we've had 4 attacks, 2 of them being double murders that have happened in about a month. So up until now, the 4 people that have been attacked were young adults, except for Polly. She was 17. It just gets worse. So on April 14th, Paul Martin, who was 16, and Betty Jo Booker was 15. They had gone to a high school dance. They had been friends for a very, very long time. They just went together. And then they just, apparently, one source said that Betty was being picked up by Paul at like 1:30 in the morning. But I'm like, what parent in the right mind is letting their 15-year-old out at 1:30 in the morning? I don't know. Regardless, they were hanging out. And unfortunately... Oliver says hello, if you guys heard that. Unfortunately, both of their bodies were found at the Spring Lake Park on the Texas side, some distance away from their car, so the assailant didn't put their bodies back in the car. But this is very important, and I will talk about this later. The keys for the vehicle were still inside of the car. Again, they were shot with a .32 weapon, presumably like a handgun revolver. Paul's body, which was found around 6:30 in the morning, was on the north side of the North Park Road. He was shot 4 times, once through the nose, once through the ribs, and a 3rd time in his right hand, probably in a defensive way. And then he finally through the back of the neck, which is what killed him. Betty, who was found 5 hours after him, she probably, because her body was kind of hiding, it was behind a tree, it was clothed, and her right hand was inside one of her pockets. They're not sure if that was because of staging or if that's just how she died. She was shot 2 times, once through the chest and 1 in the face. So,
wow.
Yeah. Very personal with her. It's crazy. So Betty had, again, been tortured and sexually assaulted before she had died. Law enforcement said that it looked like the couple had put up a fight against their attacker, probably because they were some distance from each other. Obviously, that defensive wound for Paul was kind of telltale with that. And then this is when they started offering rewards for any valid information on the killer. So because of this happening within a 2-month span, police then started to patrol secluded area of roads that were known as Lover Lanes, because this is where these kept happening. So then on May 3rd, around 9 o'clock at night, like a little bit less than a month later, things kind of took a completely different turn. And I will talk about if whether or not these are even the same killer. Because it takes a completely different MO.
Before you start, Kansas City is between Kansas and Missouri. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's another split town? Mm-hmm. That's so weird. Mm-hmm. Does it just, like, it just grows, like, past the state line, do you think?
I don't know.
I don't know either. Oliver's in a talky mood. Anyway, so Virgil Starks, May 3rd, around 9 o'clock at night, he was 37 years old, was shot 2 times by an attacker who was standing outside of his house through a closed window. So
very different.
Yeah, very different. So Virgil's like standing in this window. He was reading a newspaper. He wasn't standing out the window. He was sitting inside his home near the window reading the paper when the killer got to the window and shot him 2 times from outside. So goes through this window. It was an isolated farmhouse, so like kind of the middle of nowhere in Miller County, Arkansas. So Virgil's wife, Katie Starks, heard the shots. She was in the same area. She had no idea what happened, but she runs to the phone and she ends up being shot 2 times in the face through the same window. So he has some pretty good aim, it seems. Even though she was wounded and in the face, she was able to run from the house and she ran to another farmhouse. They're very big distance from each other, but she was able to run to a neighbor's home and then called for help. So a .22 pistol had been used in Virgil's death. It's not a .32, but I don't know. People collect guns. And there were tire tracks similar to those in the earlier cases that were found at the scene. So that's how they have kind of connected the crimes together. So it was attributed to the same killer. To make matters worse, apparently as officers were driving down to the Starks' house after receiving the call, they passed a vehicle on the side of the road that was near a clump of woods. They didn't think anything of it because that stretch of road that they were in was rural, it was open, like I'm saying. So it was a very popular moonshine drop-off. And they were like, it's probably just a moonshine drop-off. We have a crime to go to, though, like a guy that's shooting people. So they decided to not investigate it, not think about it, and just go to the priority call. But it could have been the murderer, because when they had time to go back and investigate it, the Arkansas State Troopers, Max Tackett and Charlie Boyd, found nothing. While in the operating room of the hospital, Katie Stark was questioned on the event by Miller County Sheriff W.E. Davis, and they took her testimony and then ended up at the house finding a flashlight without fingerprints. That was left by, presumably, the killer underneath the window that Mr. Starks was killed from. Hmm. Although the weapon in the case, like I said, was a .22 caliber rifle. Or did I say pistol? Well, apparently I have two different sources here. One says a pistol, one says a rifle. So after that, rewards had increased. So they were like, let's get this guy arrested. We just don't want him on the loose because he's obviously escalating. But apparently by November 1948, 2 years after that all of this started, authorities no longer considered the Starks' murder connected to the double murders. But again, I only found that through the Criminal Minds fandom page. So don't know how true that is because I couldn't find it anywhere else. And literally anytime you Google this, the Starks case is always considered part of this specific killer. So because of all these crazy murders happening, the paranoia and chaos of the town ensued. And then, especially with the Starks, neighbors started reporting that they were seeing lights coming from the farmhouse. So local police were like, fuck this, we're gonna get the killer. They surround the home and they find out that it's a Texas Ranger and a woman reporter from Life magazine that was taking photos of the crime scene with flashbulbs.
Oh
yeah,
that looks bad.
It does look bad, but we'll talk more about that Texas Ranger in a second. In all, 2 women and 3 men were killed. And again, there was panic in the area, so people started to dread when the sun was going to go down because all of these murders happened at nighttime. I mean, I feel like it's just common to dread when nighttime comes in general. But keep that in the mind for the future because I will talk about that phrase again. So women of means ended up packing their clothes and their children and checked into hotels when their husbands were gone because they were scared of being attacked. Others rigged like security systems, like strings that were attached to pots and pans that were like strung around their property because they were trying to like catch, like have like an alarm system basically. People who never owned guns basically went and bought a bunch of weapons and kept them in the house with them. And then they even had their children sleep on the floor beside them in case anything happened. Law enforcement officials in both Arkansas and Texas obviously were working the case, and the FBI and even Texas Rangers, who was the guy that was in the farmhouse. So that specific ranger was a Manuel, quote, Lone Wolf Gonzalez, who was a very well-known Texas Rangers captain, and he is very popular. Obviously, reporters from all over the country flocked the town. So the murders were soon dubbed the Moonlight Murders by the news media, though it was noted that the first two occurred a week after the full moon, and the final attack occurred around the same time of the new moon. So they thought that he was doing something with the moon phases. I think it might have just been a coincidence. So also because the killer seemed to strike and then vanish, the killer had also been dubbed the Phantom Killer by the local newspaper, the Texarkana Gazette. Numerous individuals claimed to be the perp. Several, if you look it up, there's so many that have like ties to the people. Like the one of the girls was a saxophone player. I think it was the 15-year-old Betty Joe. She played the saxophone, and one of the people that she was in band with basically was like, oh, I did it, I killed her. But this was like, and he was like going down the tube anyways. So a lot of, you'll find crazy stories with that if you look it up more. But there was also one accusation that was given by a local resident who pointed the blame at the Internal Revenue Service, or an agent, I'm sorry, of the Internal Revenue Service, but obviously those claims never went anywhere. One young man, a student at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, who came from a prominent Texarkana family, ended up killing himself in his room in the University of Arkansas, leaving a poem and a confession, saying that he did it, but after investigation, that turned out to be a false claim. One of the people who was a suspect is cited as the most probable killer in this case. He is a repeat offender. His name is Yoel Swinney. He was 29 years old. He had a record for car theft, counterfeiting, burglary, and assault. He originally was tied to this case because an Arkansas law enforcement official, Max Tackett, had noticed that before each murder, there were reports of a car being stolen and then abandoned. In June, police ended up arresting Swinney for stealing cars, but as they drove him to the station, Swinney asked a strange question for someone accused of a car theft. He said, quote, will they give me the chair, end quote. which is very interesting because you don't usually get killed for stealing cars.
Right.
So that led police to suspect that they had ended up arresting the Phantom Killer because they thought he was going to confess to all the other murders. He didn't. But then in July 1946, a stakeout of a reported stolen car in the Arkansas side of Texarkana led police to a woman who claimed to be Swinney's girlfriend. She was indeed. Her name is Peggy. She was 21. She provided details of the murders that had not been released to the public. And when Peggy heard heard that Swinney had been held for murder, though he wasn't, they didn't have sufficient evidence. I think that was just a rumor that was going around. And asked police, how did they find out? And so they were like, find out what? And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't say anything. So eventually, Peggy did end up taking officers to the spot where Paul Martin's car was found, claiming to have been there. And officers, again, this was something that wasn't released to the public, but they did find a woman's heel print in the area of the murder at the time. So they think, was this Peggy's heel print? Was she helping Paul? Yeah. Or not Paul, helping Swinney with the murders. So with his arrest and information, officers will go... would go into Swinney's home, and they ended up finding a khaki work shirt within the in his room with a laundry mark of the word Stark, which was able to be read under a black light. So I'm not sure how he had gotten this secretly into his shirt, or like why they were like, let's just put a black light on this thing. But that's very interesting. And in that front pocket of the shirt, a slag was found, which matched samples found in Virgil's welding shop. So, kind of tying him to the murder scene there. So then Swinney also owned a .32 Colt automatic, which he had sold at a crap game. That's not suspicious.
Interesting.
Subsequently, eventually, Peggy's story changed, and she ended up marrying Swinney. So because of that, and not only the unreliable in her like testimony, she would say something and then take it back or like change the story.
They weren't gonna have her testify against him.
Yeah, they could not force her to testify against her husband now, which is a very smart part. He probably was like, we need to get married because you fucked this shit up. So they declined to prosecute because everything that they had against him was her testimony. So now they were like, we basically have this evidence that's kind of not substantial enough to put somebody away for all, well, like 6 murders now and 2 attacks. So in 1947, Swinney ended up being jailed for life as a repeat offender for car theft, but he was released on an appeal in 1973. Some sources say that he ended up dying in prison because he's just a criminal. He kept going back in. But then others say that he died in 1994 in a nursing home in Dallas. Either way, he fucking died. So the Texas Rangers ended up leaving Texarkana in October 1946 without letting anyone know in order to keep the killer from attempting another attack. They thought that, like, their presence there was hindering everything from happening. But then in May 1946, a man was found in the Kansas City Southern Railway tracks north of Texarkana near Ogden, Arkansas. He was face down on the tracks. It was later discovered that the man had been allegedly killed with a sharp object and then placed on the tracks. This man was named Earl McScapton, but he was finally basically identified as kind of a transient, but at the time they thought that he was the killer and just attempted suicide. But it, like I said, it was found to be that he was killed. So then because of that, some people thought that he was the final victim of the Phantom Killer. Either way, that was just a fun tidbit. Though no other crime has occurred in the Texarkana area that could be linked to the Phantom Killer, obviously there are still crimes there, but nothing nearly as substantial or coincidental. To the date, the identity, like I said, the Phantom Killer remains unknown, and nearly 400 people have been arrested in connection with the killings. While theoretically the case is still open, it is considered a cold case. So I'm going to talk a little bit. This part I literally just got from the Criminal Minds fandom page, and I hate that I use this so much, but they had a really interesting tidbit about a psychologist named Dr. Anthony LaPala. He was a federal correctional institution, or I'm sorry, he worked at the federal correctional institution in Texarkana, and he kind of gave like a profile based off of what he thought that this killer would look like. He did this in a 1946 newspaper interview, and he believed that the killer was a white man between the ages of 30 to 50 years old. He considered him to be motivated by a strong sex drive and a sadist. At the same time, he was a very good planner. He was very clever and intelligent and dangerous if he was not going to be apprehended. So he also said that the killer knew at all times what was being done in the investigation, so he was keeping close ties with law enforcement, and he knew that these loner lovers' lanes were being patrolled more, so that's why he went to the Starks' house, because he's like, well, all of these roads are being patrolled, so I could get caught. Yeah, I'm going to go somewhere else. Which is what one of the things that I think is interesting with, like, problem-oriented policing. Which is a completely different topic, but it's like, if your areas of high crime, now you're just moving the crime somewhere else versus whatever. Anyways, that's another topic for a different podcast. So the psychologist also said that the murderer could have been leading a normal life and appearing to be a good citizen, like 99% of them are, such as Ted Bundy. He also said the killer was probably not a veteran in the military, or his tendencies of these sorts would have been apparent while on duty, and people probably would have known him and reported him. So he did not think that that was the case. He also didn't think that the murderer was a resident of the area, despite his knowledge of it. So he thought that he was a resident from another community who acquainted himself with Texarkana's surroundings before doing the killings. So he's familiar enough, but not a native. He also stated that because of the strengthening of the police force and multiple agencies now getting involved, he would willingly leave because of the difficulty committing a crime under those circumstances. He also reasoned that in past crimes, the only way to remain identified was to kill all the people on the scene, which he obviously failed with his first. 1948, a cold case involving the disappearance of 21-year-old Virginia Carpenter from Texarkana was thought to have been the same work of the Phantom Killer, though their main suspect, Swinney, was already in prison by the time, so they kind of threw that out. Yeah. But just wanted to throw that out there. So then in 1999 and 2000, an anonymous woman contacting a surviving family member of the murder victims apologized for, quote, what her father had done, end quote. But they couldn't find out what this woman's name was, what relation she had to anything, and also they decided, or didn't decide, but they found out that Swinney never reported to have a daughter. So, very interesting. Another reason probably why Swinney may or may not be the person for the case. So then in December 2014, Texas Monthly's Prudence McIntosh interviews a James Presley, who gave an authoritative examination in his book published November of 2014, and it is titled The Phantom Killer. This is a long title, I'm sorry. The Phantom Killer, Unlocking the Mystery of Texarkana Serial Killers, A Story of a Town in Terror. I hate when books are super long. And it's like, The Phantom Killer, colon, Unlocking the Mystery of the Serial Killer, blah, blah, blah. Colon, A Story of the Town in Terror. Like, you can just stop. You should have just said A Town in Terror. So he's pretty qualified. He's got a lot of shit. He's got a PhD from the University of Texas in Austin. He is a qualified historian, and also he loves researching, so that's usually what historians do. James is connected to the case. He had an uncle who was Bill Presley, and he was the sheriff of Bowie County, where most of these crimes took place, I believe 3 out of 4 of them. James is quoted saying, I call my father saying, during the summer of 1946, I saw Bill today, and he said we could relax now. They've caught the guy who did it. He's an ex-convict, but don't say anything about it to anyone, end quote. So James is referring to Swinney, who had never been convicted, as we know, but his Uncle Bill really thought that he was the killer. Unfortunately, Bill died before James started writing the book, and he swears that law enforcement turned over every rock to try to convict Swinney of the crimes. I think is interesting, because I know it's bad when, like, law enforcement, like, narrows in on one person and forgets to, like, open their mind to other things, but also, like, if he was the guy, and it just sucks that they couldn't find anything to, like, put the nail in the coffin. So, catch 22. But James grew up, obviously, and he ended up being a freelance writer after the murders happened, and he ended up writing an 8-page story for the Gazette, the Texarkana Gazette, on the 25th anniversary in 1971. So, what sparked James into writing his book in 2001 was he was in the area, and a crew was filming an episode of the Learning Channel TV show called Mostly True Stories, Urban Legends Revealed. So James was hanging out standing in the mossy woodland cemetery where one victim, Betty Jo Booker, is buried. So James was listening to the expert, the TV show expert, talking, and they were interviewing a man who was with Booker, Betty Jo, the night of her murder. And so he's being interviewed. And of course, they're doing it in a cemetery where she was mm-hmm. buried. It's kind of tasteless, in my opinion. But mm-hmm. As he eventually was like, whatever, this is boring, I'm going to go to my car, he noticed that the cameras for the TV show continued rolling as they interviewed a bystander who seemed to be the cemetery groundskeeper. So then James was like, you know what, I want to hear what this dude has to say. So he goes up there, and this man ends up telling a story about how law enforcement kept the killer's identity secret, even though he knew for a fact that they had fingerprints. And James is like, that's not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though he was a kid growing up, like, he had intimate details about the case because of his uncle. So he approached the crew after they ended up ending the interview with this man. And he said, like, hey, you know that everything he told you is, like, completely false. And they're like, oh, yeah, we know. But that's why our show is called Mostly True Stories. So right. Then he was like, well, you know what? Fuck you. I'm going to publish my own book and tell the actual true story. I guess in his perspective, because we never know what the real truth is. So because of that, obviously his book was published. And all of that story I got from the TexasMonthly.com website, because the journalist was telling, or was like interviewing him about that. So because of population growth now, the once secluded lover's lanes where the crimes happened are becoming suburbs. And like, think about nowadays, like going to a house and buying the home, and it's like, oh yeah, two like 16-year-olds were killed here. Cringy.
Yeah.
So I want to talk now about the Texas Ranger, Manuel Gonzalez. He, in 1940, I just put this in here because it's a really cool history into him. He was the first American of Spanish descent to achieve the rank of captain in the Texas Rangers. After his career with the Rangers, he retired in 1951, and he ended up going to Hollywood and became a technical consult for radio, television, and motion pictures, in particular the long-running 1950s show Tales of the Texas Rangers. Hmm. Not the Chuck Norris
right
TV show, which is a big bummer. But he eventually died of cancer in the age of 85 while living in Dallas, Texas. And that was on February 13th, 1977 that he died. And he was buried in the Sparkman Hillcrest Memorial Park in Dallas. So I'm going to go back to the townspeople dreading sundown, because that was the inspiration for a 1977 horror movie called The Town That Dreaded Sundown. It's produced by Charles B. Pierce, starring Ben Johnson, Don Wells, and Andrew Prine. As of 2014, the city nearly every Halloween played the movie in memoriam. Did you look it up?
Yeah, as soon as you like said it that way earlier, I'm like, I was just talking about that movie.
Yeah. So isn't that kind of gruesome that the city's just like, oh yeah, all these people died because of this murderer. We're going to play the movie about it every Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Cringy. So it's apparently a very good movie. It has those people starring in it that were popular at the time as actors and actresses. So then in 1996, the Texarkana Gazette published a 24-page special edition called, quote, The Phantom at 50, so 50th anniversary, and the crime was revisited extensively in 1996 and again in 2003 by the Dallas Morning News. So they had huge, huge pieces on the murders. But other than that, that's about all that I have. I also was going to ask you how you feel about it.
What do you mean?
Well, you said like the moment I started talking about it, you felt very Zodiac about it.
Yeah, it's like way too early. That's the problem.
Yeah, so mine was in 1946, and then the well-known San Francisco killings were in 1968.
Yeah.
So if the profile that was created is true, he would have been in his 40s and 50s-ish doing these crimes in San Francisco.
Seems a little old.
Yeah.
You think so? I don't know. Very Zodiac, but the spread is a little sketchy for me. But I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe it was the killer's son, and he was like, let me tell you what I did. And he's like, ooh, that sounds fun. I'm going to do it here.
Ooh.
Oh. Conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting that I think what happened, especially with the second double murder with the 15 and 16-year-old, mm-hmm. is that since they put up such a fight, that he got scared and then was like, I maybe can't overpower, especially mm-hmm. like two young people. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe he was off his game on that day. And so that's why he went and just, like, chose a random one house, too. One
dude, like, in his house. Yeah. Yeah. That's my other thing is, like, if that sketched him out that early to think that he would go and do it to, like, a bunch of other couples 20 years later.
Yeah, maybe he felt confident again.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe he got a gym membership.
Yeah, maybe. He was like, I've been working on this for 20 years. I think I'm strong enough now.
Let's go to San Francisco.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's super coincidental that
I agree.
They're so similar. But again, like, criminals choose crime of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And being secluded on a road that you know isn't going to be traveled very often is a crime of opportunity. And if you want to kill somebody, you're going to do it regardless. So it's just a coincidence, I suppose. But he never did it in broad daylight like Zodiac did.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Well, we should watch that movie and do a bonus episode on it.
Oh, I'm down. That sounds fun.
Sick.
All the, like, articles that I read about it was, like, screenshots of the movie. Mm-hmm. Which I know I talked a little bit about some of my sources, but I also want to mention that I looked up the Encyclopedia of Arkansas.net. I did end up using Wikipedia for just a little bit, not too much.
I don't know why there's so much stigma with Wikipedia.
I don't know, because anybody can change it to anything, but for the most part, I felt it.
They cite their sources really well, though.
Yeah, I know, and I usually use Wikipedia as, like, my very last source, and I usually just add it to, like, little tidbits here and there. Mm-hmm. It's not my main source of information. And then I also used, like I said, TexasMonthly.com, Grunge.com, the Criminal Minds website, and TheLineup.com for my sources.
Sick. Super That's sick. Crazy.
I thought it was very interesting, and that's the one, when I was looking up the Freeway Phantom Killer, that's the one that I also found and started doing research, and I was like, no, this isn't the right murder for. So I finally decided to cover that one that I talked about months ago.
Nice. Good work.
Thank you.
Okay, so mine's going to be a good palate cleanser after that. Sorry. Mine's about 2 pages of, like, a really terrible crime committer, and then 4 pages of what happened to his body, so. Are you ready to hear the strange story of Elmer McCurdy? So Elmer McCurdy was born in Washington, Maine, which is a city in Maine, on January 1st of 1880. He was the son of 17-year-old Sadie McCurdy, who was unmarried at the time of his birth. Nobody knows who his dad was. One possibility was her cousin, and people think that because her cousin's name was Charles Smith, and McCurdy would later use the name Charles Smith as an alias, but that is literally the only connection that makes people postulate on that. To save Sadie the embarrassment and shame of raising an illegitimate child, her brother George and his wife Helen adopted Elmer, and they all lived together in the same house. George died of TB in 1890, and Sadie and Helen moved with Elmer to Bangor, Maine, which, if you're reading Stephen King, that will ring a bell to you.
Bangor is everywhere with Stephen King.
Yep. Sadie eventually told her son that she, and not Helen, was his actual mom, and that she was unsure who his bio dad was. That bothered him a lot, and he ended up growing up pretty resentful and became, quote, unruly and rebellious.
Sounds very familiar with, like, 90% of serial killers.
Yeah.
Or just, like, male killers in general. They're like, I hate my mom because she lied to me.
Right. Teenager, he began drinking heavily, which was a habit that would continue his entire life. He eventually returned to Maine to live with his grandfather and became an apprentice plumber. He was a good worker. He lived really comfortably until the economic, like, downturn, like the depression.
Yeah.
I think it was, like, pre-depression, though, because this was in 1898, but there was a pretty significant economic issues going on back then. He ended up losing his job, and in August of 1900, his mom died of a ruptured ulcer. Ooh. His grandfather died of Bright's disease, I don't know what that is, the following month, so it was a really bad year for Elmer. Shortly after his grandpa died, he left Maine and began drifting around the eastern United States, where he worked as a lead miner and a plumber. He wasn't really able to hold a job because he was such a terrible alcoholic. He didn't really hide it well, and it caused him to lose a lot of jobs. He eventually made his way to Kansas, where he worked as a plumber in Cherryvale. Then he moved to Iola, Kansas, where in 1905 he was arrested for public intoxication, and then he moved to Webb City, Missouri. 1907, he joined the Army, and he was assigned to Fort Leavenworth. He was a machine gun operator, and he was trained to use nitroglycerin for demolition purposes. The extent of that training was minimal, which is important. He was honorably discharged from the Quartermaster Corps on November 7th of 1910. Then he made his way to St. Joseph, Kansas, where he met with an old army friend, and on November 19th of that year, he and his friend were arrested for possessing burglary paraphernalia. So that was like chisels and hacksaws, a bunch of funnels for some nitroglycerin that he had, some gunpowder, and a bunch of money sacks.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. The St. Joseph Gazette reported that during their arraignment, McCurdy and his friend said that the tools were not intended for burglary, but were tools that they needed to work on a machine gun that they were inventing, a foot-operated machine gun that they were supposedly inventing. 1911, he went to trial for that, and the jury found both of them not guilty. He was released from county jail, and he immediately started robbing banks and trains. So
classic.
These generally went extremely poorly.
Oh.
So we'll go through that. So first, he decided that his best move was to incorporate his minimal training with nitroglycerin into his robberies. This often caused a lot of problems because he had no idea how much to use each time, and it fucked it up every single time. March of 1911, he had relocated to Lenapa, Oklahoma. And then on March 24th of that year, he and three other men decided to rob the Iron Mountain, Missouri Pacific train number 104 after he heard that one of the cars contained a safe that had $4,000 in it. They stopped the train successfully. They found the safe, and he put a bunch of nitroglycerin on the safe's door to open it, but he used too much, which then destroyed the safe and most of the money in there.
Oh.
They managed to get around $450 in silver coins, but most of those were melted and fused to the safe's frame. So
what a bummer.
Super useful. So that went shitty. On September 21st of 1911, McCurdy and two other men attempted to rob the Citizens Bank in Chautauqua, Kansas. After spending about 2 hours breaking through the bank wall with a hammer, he again put another nitro charge around the door of the bank's outer vault. Blast blew the vault door through the bank, destroying the interior, but didn't damage the safe inside of the vault, which is what had money in it. He then tried to blow the safe door open.
Oh my gosh.
And the charge failed to ignite. No, after the lookout man got scared because it was taking too fucking long, McCurdy and his accomplices stole about $150 in coins that were in a tray outside the safe and fled. Later, I can't. It's so stupid.
it's so stupid.
Later that night, they got on a train, which took them to the Kansas border, and then they split up. McCurdy made his way to the ranch of one of his friends named Charlie Brevard near Bartlesville, Oklahoma. He stayed in a hay shed on that property for the next couple of weeks, you know, just binge drinking for the majority of that time. His final robbery took place on October 4th of 1911. Near Ocasa, Oklahoma. He and two accomplices planned to rob a Katy train after hearing that it contained $400,000 in cash that was intended as a royalty payment to the Osage Nation. So it was to one of the reservations there.
Yeah.
However, they mistakenly stopped a passenger train number 29 instead of the correct train. They were able to steal only $46 from the mail clerk, two big jugs of whiskey, a revolver, a coat, and the train conductor's watch.
Oh, no.
A newspaper account of the robbery later called it, quote, one of the smallest in the history of train robbery.
That's depressing.
He was obviously disappointed by this, so he returned to the ranch that he was staying on October 6th, where he started again drinking, and this time he's drinking all the jugs of whiskey that he stole. By this time, he was also pretty sick with TB, which he had developed after working in the mines, and along with a mild case of pneumonia. Mm. Stayed up drinking with some of the ranch hands before he fell asleep in the hayloft the following morning. Unbeknownst to McCurdy, he had been implicated in the robbery, and a $2,000 reward for his capture had been issued. Morning hours of October 7th, a posse of three sheriffs, two of which were brothers Bob and Stringer Fenton, and another sheriff named Dick Wallace, tracked McCurdy to the hay shed using bloodhounds, surrounded the hay shed, waited for daylight. McCurdy kind of like wakes up in his drunk stupor, sees them, and immediately starts shooting at them.
Oh gosh.
About an hour of like back and forth gunfire goes on, and finally Mercurti stops shooting, so they approach him and they find that one round struck him in the chest and killed him after an hour's worth of shooting back and forth.
What? So. Also, like, one round is what kills him. Like, that's, like, good shooting, but also, like, not.
Yeah.
Like, really bad shooting.
So, that's the extent of the true crime here.
Okay. That's it?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad that this murder happened to, like, somebody who, like, I wouldn't say, like it didn't happen to, like, a person that
was
just
great at it, but he probably needed to be stopped because it was just getting ridiculous at that point.
Yeah, not like I wanted him to be killed, but, like, if it were to happen to anybody, at least it happened to somebody like him rather than a 15-year-old that was just leaving high school.
Yeah. So, his body ends up being taken to the Undertaker in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, where it went unclaimed. The owner and the Undertaker, his name was Joseph Johnson, and he embalmed the body.
That's like a Phasmo name.
I know, right?
Joseph Johnson. Joseph Johnson. Can you give me a sign?
He embalmed the body with an arsenic-based preservative, which was typically used in embalming in that era to preserve a body for a lot longer. Mm-hmm. And that was generally done when there was no, like, next of kin. Like, it was going to take longer for the body to be claimed.
Yeah.
So then he shaves the face, dresses the body in a suit, stores it in the back of the funeral home. McCurdy's going unclaimed, and Johnson's getting pissed, and he's refusing to bury or release the body until he gets paid for his services. And then he decides to exhibit McCurdy to make money. So he dresses the corpse in street clothes, places a rifle in his hands, and stood it up in the corner of the funeral home. And then for a nickel, he allowed people to come in and see what he called, quote, the bandit who wouldn't give up. Also at various times called, these were various names that were given to McCurdy's corpse, the mystery man of many aliases, the Oklahoma outlaw, and the embalmed bandit. Fun fact.
That's perfect.
This also became a very popular attraction at the funeral home and drew the attention of some carnival promoters. Johnson received numerous offers to sell McCurdy's corpse, but he refused to do that. On October 6th of 1916, a man calling himself Aver, which is not a name, that was his name, contacted Joseph Johnson, claiming to be Elmer McCurdy's long-lost brother from California. Aver had already contacted the Osage County, Oklahoma sheriff and a local attorney to get permission to take custody of the body and ship it to San Francisco for proper burial. Following day, Aver arrived at the Johnson funeral home with another man who was calling himself Wayne, who also claimed to be another one of McCurdy's brothers. Or he didn't have any brothers. So,
interesting.
Johnson releases the body to these men who put it on a train supposedly going to San Francisco, but instead they shipped it to, it's spelled like Arkansas, but it is Arkansas City, Kansas. And I know this because the town I went to college in my first year was literally 10 minutes away from this town.
And they got mad when you said
we just
it
called it Ark City.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, technically it was Arkansas City, Kansas. So the men who claimed to be McCurdy's long-lost brothers were, in fact, James and Charles Patterson. James Patterson was the owner of the Great Patterson Carnival Shows, a traveling carnival. After learning from his brother Charles about the popular embalmed bandit exhibit, the two came up with this plan to take possession of the body so that they could use it in their own carnivals. McCurdy's corpse would be featured in Patterson's traveling carnival as, quote, the outlaw who would never be captured alive, which is the longest name for an attraction ever. Very cumbersome to say. This was until 1922 when Patterson sold his operation to a man named Louis Sunny. He used McCurdy's corpse in his traveling museum of crime, kind of cool, which featured wax replicas of famous outlaws such as Bill Doolin and Jesse James.
That is cool.
In 1928, the corpse was part of the official sideshow that accompanied the Trans-American Foot Race, kind of cool. And in 1933, it was acquired for a time by director Dwayne Esper to promote his exploitation film called Narcotic. It was like a...
Have you seen that show?
It was like a dare. No, oh. It was like DARE, the DARE program.
Oh, they called it Narcotic?
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking dumb.
So in this film, the corpse was placed in the lobby of the different theaters that this film was being shown in and was promoted as a, quote, dead dope fiend.
Oh.
Whom Esper claimed had killed himself while surrounded by police after he had robbed a drugstore to support his habit. By the time Esper acquired McCurdy's body, it had become mummified at this point. The skin was hard and shriveled, and it caused the body to shrink quite a bit. So he claimed that the skin's deterioration was proof that he was actually a drug abuser.
Oh my god.
After Louis Sonny died in 1949, the corpse was placed in storage in a Los Angeles warehouse. In 1964, Sonny's son, Dan, lent the corpse to filmmaker David F. Friedman. It eventually made a brief appearance in Friedman's 1967 film, She Freak. And then in 1968, Dan Sonny sold the body along with a bunch of other wax figures for $10,000 to Spoonie Singh, who was the owner of the Hollywood Wax Museum. Singh had bought the figures for two Canadian men who exhibited them at a show that they had at Mount Rushmore.
Oh my god.
And while being exhibited there, the corpse sustained some damage in a windstorm. The tips of the ears, along with the fingers and the toes, were all blown off.
Oh my gosh.
The men eventually returned the corpse back to Singh, who decided that it looked too gruesome and not lifelike enough to exhibit.
So because it's dead.
Yep. So then he sold it to a guy named Ed Liersch, who was a part owner of the Pike, which was an amusement park in Long Beach, California. And by 1976, McCurdy's corpse was hanging in the Laugh in the Dark Funhouse exhibition at the Pike. So it was like hanging there.
No, no, in a funhouse? So like children were seeing this?
Yeah. So,
oh my god.
This brings us to
that's so bad.
December 8th of 1976, a production crew of the television show The $6 Million Man was filming scenes for the, quote, the Carnival of Spies episode in Long Beach at the Pike. Oh. During the shoot, a prop man moved what he thought was a wax mannequin that was hanging from a gallows. And when the mannequin's arm broke off, human bone and muscle tissue were visible. So then they call police, and the mummified corpse was taken to the LA coroner's office, and on December 9th, Dr. Joseph Choi conducted an autopsy and determined the body was that of a human male who had died of a gunshot wound to the chest. Body was completely petrified, covered in wax, and then had been covered in layers of phosphorus paint.
So, like, what did that make it glow in the dark?
I guess. That's the only thing I can think of. At this point, it weighed approximately 50 pounds. And was 63 inches in height, so that's 5'3". Some hair was still visible on the sides and the back of the head, while the ears, big toes, and fingers were all missing. The examination also revealed incisions from his original autopsy and embalming. Tests conducted on the tissue showed that there was a presence of arsenic, which, like we said, was part of the embalming process for more long-term embalming. And they also revealed tuberculosis in the lungs, which McCurdy had developed while working as a miner, bunions, and scars that McCurdy was documented to have had. So they're just gathering all of this information that would make it like this was Elmer McCurdy.
Yeah.
All these clues kind of helped investigators pinpoint the era where the man had been killed. And further clues were found when his jaw was removed for dental analysis. And inside the mouth was a 1924 penny and ticket stubs to the 140 West Pike Sideshow and Louis Sonny's Museum of Crime. Tickets were stuffed in his mouth.
Oh my god.
Investigators then contacted Dan Sonny, who confirmed the body was real, and he knew it was real, and it was Elmer McCurdy. So then they called like a forensic anthropologist to make a positive identification, and just more and more evidence to pinpoint who this guy was. December 11th, the story of McCurdy's journey had been featured in newspapers and on television and on the radio. Several funeral homes called the coroner's office offering to bury him free of charge, but officials decided to wait to see if any living relatives would come forward to claim the body. A guy named Fred Olds, who represented the Indian Territory Posse of Oklahoma Westerns, eventually convinced Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who was then the chief medical examiner and coroner for LA County. He probably sounds familiar. Because we've done true crime before.
We have done true crime before.
he convinced him to allow him to bury the body in Oklahoma, where he was at a lot. After further testing to ensure proper identification, Olds was allowed to take custody of the body. And on April 22nd, 1977, a funeral procession was conducted to transport McCurdy to the Boot Hill section of Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma. A graveside service attended by approximately 300 people was conducted, after which he was buried next to another outlaw, Bill Doolin. And then to ensure that his body wouldn't get taken again, they poured 2 feet of concrete over his casket.
Jesus Christ, that's a little excessive.
And that's the story of Elmer McCurdy.
Dang, that's crazy. I can't believe he was put in a fun house. That's so fucked up, dude. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
All these things because of this guy's body was, like, preserved.
For, like, 60 years. Oh, it was just
passed around.
Passed around.
That's pretty insane. Pretty
crazy.
That is crazy. That's really spooky.
Yeah.
Spooky true crime.
Yeah, right?
Good for you.
Thank you.
That was fun.
Good. Glad you liked it. That's all I have. Do you have anything else?
I couldn't remember what my update was, so.
Okay.
Listen to next week's episode where I might remember.
Sick.
Yes.
And again, if you want to follow us on Instagram, that's super cool. You can email us at whoknewpodcast666@gmail.com, or you can find us on Patreon where we release a bunch of cool stuff. Do bonus episodes and videos of our actual ghost hunts and good shit like that. So feel free to do that. And other than that.
That's it.
Cool.
All we got. Goodbye. I'm just kidding.